This is our Huye reading group, picking up for our first session of the new year, continuing our reading of Neo-Finalism, starting chapter 7 of the book, the title of which is Signification of Equipotentiality. So that is page 68 of the translation. Just to do like a quick recap of the previous chapter, that one was looking at, this is sort of like his, one of his kind of key analogies, the analogy between the brain and the embryo, or between learning in the adult organism and development of the embryo into an adult organism. So in each of these cases, there's like a, you sort of start from this undifferentiated state, and so like the embryo, for example, is this sort of undifferentiated blob of jelly, and then over the course of development, it gives itself structure. It, you know, forms a head and tail direction, and, you know, left and right, you know, different organs and limbs and tissues and so on. And the sort of key point here is that it's not, there's nothing, you can't sort of explain this development in terms of something that would pre-exist and sort of direct the development. You're precisely trying to explain how these like differentiated structures develop in the first place. And so you can't like explain that developmental process by just saying there's like, you know, a blueprint with like the left and right already distinguished or something like that. And likewise, in the case of learning, that, you know, we have, you know, capacities to learn many different things. We have this sort of equipotentiality in our sort of, I don't know, cognitive state or psychological state that, you know, depending on what kinds of experiences we have, we might learn different things. You know, you might, in, you know, a child in a certain environment might pick up a certain musical instrument, and then in a different environment, maybe that instrument doesn't exist, and so they would learn a different musical instrument. You know, so what sort of skills and knowledge you acquire over your lifetime depends on what you're exposed to. But in each of these cases, you have this sort of like, so you have this sort of equipotential starting state, this state that could develop into many different things. And then over the course of this learning slash development process, you sort of take on the structure. So like by learning an instrument, you're sort of building a kind of, I don't know, psychological machine within yourself that is capable of, you know, performing, you know, certain patterns on that instrument without having to, you know, think about where to place your finger at any given moment. So this is sort of like the central analogy of these of that chapter. And then the last little bit that sort of leads into this one is he talked about different attempts to sort of explain away this sort of differentiation or this epigenesis of structure. So trying to like find a sort of pre-existing structure that would explain how the embryo apparently takes on structure, and how the brain apparently takes on structure in learning. And so in the last one that he lands on, or the last one that he discusses, is a kind of hybrid account, which is probably easiest to understand in relation to embryology. So this would be an account that would sort of combine like a continuous kind of gradient element of explanation together with a discrete I guess quasi-mechanical element of explanation. And this is essentially the sort of default pattern of explanation that is used in developmental biology today as well. So when you're trying to you know, explain the development of, I don't know, a fruit fly or whatever it is, there's the gradient in the egg that determines, say, like the head to tail direction within the egg. There's some sort of chemical difference that varies continuously from head to tail, and then there's also the genes within the egg, and then the sort of different concentrations of that chemical in that defines the head to tail gradient. Lead or sort of trigger the expression of different genes at different points, and that of course, you know, has this sort of complicated chain reaction where, you know, the expression of one gene produces a substance that triggers the expression of another gene, and so on, and yeah, so there's a kind of like you know, sort of hierarchical chain reaction that brings about the differentiation of all these different structures within the fruit fly. So it's a sort of combination of like the continuous gradient and then the sort of mechanism that is the genes. So Huye criticizes this kind of explanation, but he is going to, in the next chapter, sort of show, or argue that there is a kind of a grain of truth to this sort of duality in you know, explaining development, and that's sort of where where we pick up at the beginning of chapter 7. So yeah, we can start from chapter 7.
I can read. Chapter 7, Signification of Equipotentiality. There is nonetheless some measure of truth in the dualist theories, as we indicated in chapter 5. The duality of the nervous system is real. As receptor and effector system on one side, with its anatomic dispositions and its physiological availabilities, and on the other, as living equipotential tissue, and as such, in relation, like every living tissue, with the domain of spatiotemporal senses. Because positivist scientists refuse to recognize this domain, they try to fabricate its equivalent on the plane of anatomy and physiology, naturally without success. Quote-unquote, positivist scientists do not seem to realize that this failure is very fortunate for the unity and intelligibility of these facts, and thus for the intelligibility of science. Let us suppose, contrary to all possibility, that one of the preceding theories, or a new related theory, proves to be absolutely true. Everything would then become objectively clear in the neural operation, even the most paradoxical facts revealed by Lashley's experiments. Everything, except the role of consciousness. We would no longer understand what consciousness does in the world, in the real world, precisely because we could completely explain the neural operation. We would find ourselves in the same situation that we were in at the time of Huxley and Maudsley. Back then, it was thought that the neural operation could be explained by ready-made connections, and, therefore, that consciousness had no longer any use, like the cogs that, in the famous story, the watchmaker realizes he forgot on the table after having reassembled the watch, which works perfectly. That it is impossible to explain cerebral equipotentiality, quote-unquote, causally, should seem entirely natural. This equipotentiality marks the site where a coupling can take place between the cerebral system as a system and the world of consciousness and thematic senses that make use of this system. Not like a pianist uses his keyboard, but in a much more subtle way we have yet to study. The man's consciousness, memory, and ideas do not constitute a spiritual, quote-unquote, second man, avatar of the, quote-unquote, gaseous vertebrate, who is superimposed on the first man of flesh. They constitute a proper domain that can be regarded, in a first approximation, as distinct from the, quote-unquote, observable cerebral system. Both because of their analogy and because behavior is indissociable from organization, we are forced to treat cerebral equipotentiality and embryonic equipotentiality in the same way. The observable embryo, like the observable brain, cannot represent its entire reality without contradiction. Like the brain, it is in a relation with the domain of memory and signifying themes, which take hold of it and dominate the visible structural transformation. Numerous signs indicate that these two, quote-unquote, inobservable domains are one. The organic memory that guides the differentiations of the embryo, the organic interventions that perfect the species in the course of successive ontogeneses, closely resemble psychological and individual consciousness and the faculty of invention. The same effects are owed to them. Their borders are very fluid. What is a tool, in certain cases, the product of psychological consciousness, is an organ, in other cases, the product of organic consciousness. The brain is an embryo that has not finished its growth. The embryo is a brain that begins to organize itself before organizing the external world. Yeah, this is a very interesting perspective kind of the non-reducibility, I guess, of something like the brain or the embryo as an observable system on the one hand, and the brain or the embryo as he puts it here, a relay for mnemic themes, but you know, in some sense, as a conscious experience of the world. So, in a way analogous to how, you know, if I'm sitting at the table with someone and I can observe them talking to me, their experience of the world doesn't reduce to my observation of them. You know, this is also the case for Rouillet, for embryos and other true forms. Equipotentiality has this kind of non-observable component, which is this access to relay relationship, I guess, with this abstract domain.
Yeah. This bit about the last line there, you know, the brain, the embryo, makes me think of Simondon's explanation of how vital individuation is a kind of slowing down of physical individuation. And we could see this sort of within the realm of vital individuation, there's a sort of, again, the same kind of, I guess, temporality difference that it sort of underlies the difference between, say, an embryo and a brain. And so the embryo develops into all these different structures, like, you know, kidneys and a heart and so on. But, you know, once, I mean, the kidney, of course, grows in your body as you, you know, age from childhood into your sort of full size at adulthood. But the sort of general, you know, performance of what the kidney is doing is more or less the same when you're, you know, 5 years old and 25 years old. Whereas your brain, of course, is, you know, at birth, you are really not capable of much in terms of, you know, behavior of various kinds. And then, you know, over the course of your childhood, teenage years, you know, into adulthood, even, you're still, I mean, all the way through your life, really, your brain is still, you know, transforming itself over time and, you know, acquiring new skills and forgetting skills that aren't needed anymore and so on. There's maybe a kind of openness or, capacity for further development that is retained in the brain in a way that other organs don't have, after the sort of developmental process is finished. This bit about, I think, observation, we're going to go in, there's going to be a lot more discussion of this, you know, what exactly is going on with this observation question, throughout the next few chapters. But I think this sort of like duality that he's talking about here is sort of like the inner experience of something versus observation from outside. And so, of course, we as like a sort of psychological subject have an inner experience. But he's, you know, talking about not just the level of a psychological subject, a human being as a sort of single entity that has a unity, but also, you know, each of the cells in our body is has a sort of inner side to it, and that inner side is what's actually more fundamental. And then, you know, of course, you could put one of your cells under the microscope and look at it, but that is a kind of external observation of that cell, which is not the same as the cell's own, you know, inner experience. And I think we can also connect this with Spinoza's distinction between natura naturata and natura naturans. So natura naturata is, of course, the produced entities or like the result of the developmental process. And these are, you know, the cells that we can observe under the microscope, for example. And then natura naturans would be, the actual sort of process of production of these cells themselves. And this is what Rui is talking about here as this kind of relay or mediation between this realm of themes or values, he sometimes calls it, or meanings, and then the sort of end product is a certain spatiotemporal arrangement, a muscle cell, for example. The process that he's talking about here is not not immediately, at least, it's not a sort of process happening in space and time, but it's this sort of transition from these non-spatial temporal themes into the physical worlds, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, I really like the way this chapter opens, because like we were saying before the recording, I mean, this is where he's really taking off. And just to me, like he sets it up, obviously, he giving some credence to this, to the duality of the nervous system and opposing the positivist view to his view here. Basically, in his dualist view, you have one, which is the receptor effector anatomical physiological structure versus the living equipotential tissue, which can function in relation to what he calls the domain of spatiotemporal senses. And so when he says that the positivist view only holds to the first one, and then says, but if this was true, obviously, the neural operation alone would be sufficient. And so everything, consciousness, everything about our consciousness and our adaptability would be unnecessary, that the initial program would be sufficient for behavior. And so for me, I just lost my train of thought. But essentially, what he's saying here to me is that, so just like with the embryo, where it starts off equipotential, but it's sort of where he talks about, but over time, it becomes a little bit more closed off. Like you were saying, it hardens into the organs and stuff. The brain is open behavior. It can continue to respond to the environment. And if we only had the first option, that openness wouldn't be available to us. And so I haven't read a lot of Simondon. I wish I had, but what you were saying about the vital individuation, I think that's basically what he's saying. If the brain wasn't an equipotential tissue, we wouldn't have that option for that vital individuation to continue. But another thing I like too is, you know, with the current biology, the current state of biology, they would probably allow for a few more degrees of complexity, but they still hold to that positivist view with the physiological structure, and there's still that failure to really understand what he's laying out here with the equipotential domain, which is basically the allowance for our open behavior. So it was a good start.
Yeah, so so you're right that this is it's going to be more complicated in contemporary biology, because you have another 50, 60 years worth of study of how the nervous system works, for example, that you have to sort of account for in presenting this. So one thing I think maybe that is worth sort of pointing out here is that, of course, human brains are not sort of entirely open in the sense that anyone can learn anything at any point in their lives. And so like one important example of like a sort of non-openness is language learning. It certainly seems, I mean, there isn't really sort of decisive evidence, but it seems that there is like a sort of critical period where you have to be exposed to language in childhood to be able to actually learn a human language. There are a few of these horrible cases of parents who like basically kept their children like locked in a cellar and never spoke to them. And many of the, and you know, they maybe only get rescued when they're like, 12, 14, whatever years old. Most of these cases, the people never sort of develop, normal language skills. Obviously this is not a sort of like controlled experiment in the sense that, this person is not just sort of a normal person minus exposure to language and therefore minus language skills. Like there's living in that way, going through childhood in that way is going to affect many other elements of that person's development. So it does seem that like having exposure to language in childhood is essential to sort of developing normal language, competence. And then of course, anyone who's like, try to learn a language as an adult can attest that it is extremely difficult. Even people that, develop really, very good competence in their second language, they're like writing books in the second language or whatever, they're living their whole life in that second language, usually will still have like a discernible accent in that second language. Your learning of the sound system in your first language you could have learned any language as an infant. But once you have learned your first language, it then becomes much harder to learn the sound system of another language. So there is a kind of like closing off of that potentiality once you are sort of, once you select the language that you're going to learn, obviously not, the child is not sort of like picking out the language from a menu, but like, the surroundings, of course, sort of do the selection for them. But yeah, from that starting equipotentiality where the child could learn any language once they have, you know, narrowed down to the one language or maybe a couple of languages that they're exposed to in childhood, then that equipotentiality is narrowed down to that one language to a considerable extent, though not entirely, of course. It is possible to learn, you know, new languages in adulthood. It's just, yeah, your ability to do so is constrained by the language or languages you already know. So yeah, it's not a sort of complete openness that, you know, you can learn anything. And language learning, of course, is a kind of a special case because there's, you know, a lot of reason to think that, anatomically modern humans, evolved to some extent, to have like linguistic abilities that we have, whereas, you know, other skills are, you know, much less, built in, and maybe have less of that loss of equipotentiality over time. But yeah, in general, I think it's fair to say that, you know, learning new skills is easier for young people than it is for older people. But it doesn't mean, of course, that, you know, older people can't learn new skills.
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, like the embryo, it's there is some, I guess, time scale to this or whatever. Like early at the beginning of embryonic development, the grafts, you know, if you graft it, it can take on the domain of the embryo it's grafted into versus later when it follows its own original course. And so the brain, so that equipotentiality perhaps over time or within certain domains may become a little bit more hard, but overall it remains open and responsive to those external signals.
Yeah. So like, yeah, there is a sort of narrowing down of the equipotentiality. So yeah, the infant at birth could learn any of the 4,000 or so human languages that are out there. But then, you know, over the course of the first, you know, months and years of its life, it will, be exposed to only a few of those languages and will narrow down. It will sort of differentiate itself into, an English speaking or a Japanese speaking child. But of course, yeah, it doesn't sort of completely lose those that potentiality to learn a different language. It's not the case that, you know, after age 6 you can't learn another language or something like that. You're sort of like trapped in you've sort of like frozen into the, you know, English speaking brain state or something like that. So yeah, it's definitely much harder to sort of come back and start again with a new language. It's not a sort of complete loss of that potentiality. Whereas I think, like in the case of there are certain birds that have to be exposed to like adult bird singing to be able to learn the sort of normal song of their species. And they also, like, there's variation in different places, which has sometimes been described as a kind of culture in these birds, because like the birds learn the sort of typical song of their area, and then if you take one of these birds and bring it to a different area, you take an egg of one of these birds and let it hatch in a different area, it that hatchling will learn the song of the area that it grows up in rather than its parent's song. But in most of these birds, there is like a pretty sharp like cutoff in the sense that if you take the bird after that sort of critical period of learning and move it to the new area, it will continue to sing the song from its old area. There doesn't seem to be any capacity to sort of adapt to the new area's song. So it just sort of, once it's kind of selected that one type of song out of the whole repertoire that it could learn, then it no longer has the capacity to learn a different type. So there's no, like, I don't know, bilingual birds, I guess, in an extended sense here. So humans have more openness in that sense than these different songbirds do.
Yeah. And I was reading the chat and I just saw that probably the better corollary for Royer's equipotentiality is Simondon's metastability.
Yeah, so metastability is kind of a key concept for Simondon that I think plays a similar role as equipotentiality, in the sense that, Simondon emphasizes that there, like, the sort of potential element in human existence, but also in various other types of entities like living beings and so on, that we can't think of it as a sort of like a sort of potential that just gets used up and then is left sort of as a equilibrium state, which is sort of the gestalt type of explanation that Ruyer also criticizes, where you'd have like a sort of tension or potential, and then you just use up that tension in order to dissipate the tension, follow the gradient towards the lowest point of tension or whatever, and then the system would just sort of stay at that equilibrium state. Simondon, like Ruyer, points out that this is not how living systems behave in general, that they don't just sort of use up pre-existing potentials and then sit there and do nothing, that they instead are sort of like intrinsically active, and so that this notion of metastability is a kind of stability or it's a stability that is not sort of devoid of potential for further transformation, in the same way that in the case of like the embryo, for example, it undergoes differentiation, but that doesn't mean that the organism that results from that differentiation is sort of like fixed and can't itself undergo further differentiation and transformation.
One thing I'm enjoying about one thing I'm enjoying about reading Ruyer after reading some Husserl is that Husserl is obviously only concerned with human experience, individual and intersubjective. And I find, some of Husserl's writings convincing, some less convincing, but it's pretty dissatisfying to, just kind of leave aside the question of, the experience of children and infants, for instance, or non-human animals, and beyond that, just kind of form-taking generally. If Husserl is right about kind of constitution of experience and consciousness, that has to come about somehow. It would be surprising and like seemingly literally miraculous if it were limited to human experience. And so, coming from a Husserlian perspective, Ruyer kind of fills in, obviously in a much more speculative vein than I think Husserl would be comfortable with, but in a way that in a sense seems necessary if the fact of experience, human experience, is going to make sense at all. The experience of other kinds of forms.
Yeah. Husserl always sort of like starts from, the adult Austrian philosophy professor experience. That's sort of like his reference point for everything. Even just the basic facts of like, how does the child get to the point where they are capable of, having an intentional direction to an object, seeing the table rather than just having a sort of sense experience of a dark pattern on the retina or whatever, or a dark region of the visual field. He gives a very, I think compelling description of like how our capacity to see a table is sort of, implies the kind of directedness through the perspectival appearance of the table, that, like, of course, you only ever see the table from a certain perspective, and you see one side of it and not the other. And this is sort of like a constitutive element of what it is to actually see something, to have a visual perception of something. But then, of course, the question is like, that is not something that humans are, it sort of just like appear in the world capable of doing. That, the infant has to actually, see a bunch of tables and walk around crawl around them and touch them and so on. And eventually, somehow, as a result of doing all this exploration, they come to grasp the fact that there's this, to sort of structure their perception in such a way that they see the table by means of the perspectives on it. So this sort of structure that he is describing of, perspectival viewing of an object that is sort of intended behind the perspectives or by means of the perspectives, this sort of structure is not sort of doesn't appear out of nowhere. You have to sort of find a way of accounting for how it is that these particular kinds of animals that are human infants are capable of acquiring that structure or grasping that structure. Okay, so I think we can go on to the next bit. Organ Nels, would you like to read from the first peculiarity?
Sure. The first peculiarity of the brain is to be in relation with the domain of themes and senses, not only directly, like the embryo, but indirectly, by means of the external objects it perceives and creates. In the adult organism, the brain is an area that has remained embryonic. It remains connected to the inobservable domain of senses, while the rest of the organism, having finished its growth, retains some contact with this domain, only to the extent that it cannot be reduced to pure, quote, substituted mechanisms, end quote, to the extent that mnemic themes and rhythms carried over from the embryonic state continue to, quote unquote, inspect these innumerable machines. The second peculiarity of the brain is that its differentiations are reversible, whereas the differentiations of the rest of the organism, except in certain inferior organisms, are generally irreversible. Placing the adult brain in circuit with mnemic themes or original senses entails only a provisional closure of the cortical network's synaptic connections, which are always physiologically open. At the moment of a definite perception or action, this closure transforms the brain instantaneously into a quote-unquote finished organ, that is, a differentiated organ like the others. A living being can only perform a single task at a time in the order of behavior. It can only have a single, quote-unquote, assembly for a given task. If, contrary to all possibilities, it could spend its entire existence in the same assembly, the cerebral connections that are thus closed for good would be comparable in their immutable anatomic structure to the connections of the renal or pulmonary tissue, which always carries out the same chemical work. In reality, the living being ceaselessly passes from one action to another. Ever new thematic systems, controlled by mental or psychic laws and not by physiological causality, alter at every instant the quote-unquote closures of the neural network, and this amounts to transforming the network into an organ with a new structure. A given psychological recollection or idea only mobilizes the brain provisionally. The brain is quickly available for another differentiation. In contrast, the mnemic themes that are successfully summoned in the course of embryonic development determine an irrevocable differentiation. Primitive embryonic equipotentiality thus disappears progressively. It is distributed in more and more limited areas. The theme of organs, by taking shape, ceases to be a theme to become a structure. The finalist sense of the organ remains obvious, but this sense is incarnated or fossilized, in the same way that the theme of invention in a machine built by an engineer is replaced by substituted mechanical links. Relative to the embryo that he was, the adult realizes in a sense the ancient myth of the divinity that is transformed into a laurel tree. To be an organ for the creation of organs is what equipotentiality allows. This definition makes clear the resemblance and the difference between the fertilized egg or the young embryo and the brain. Both respond to this definition. To say that the young embryo is like a brain at the moment when a recollection starts to emerge is not a metaphor. It is impossible to interpret the facts highlighted by experimental embryology, anteriority of determination over differentiation, Ortsgemass, or Herkenfettmass, developments of grafts, induction with regulation, etc., through mechanical or dynamical models. Only the quote, psychological model, unquote, of mnemic initiation can account for the facts, and it is not absurd to match a domain of primary consciousness to the observable embryo, just as we spontaneously match a consciousness to the observable head or brain of a living being. A senseful theme, which the observable structure expresses but does not exhaust, can only have a subjective existence. He just keeps coming with this stuff in this section. I'm going to stop here because a few things. I think here he does kind of go into, I think what I was trying to say earlier, where he's talking about how the embryo does progressively what he says becomes kind of fossilized or closed off. I really like this line, to be an organ for the creation of organs, is what equipotentiality allows. And that is, so when people want to know what the purpose of your life is, it's be an organ for the creation of organs. But there was another section in here I really liked. But yeah, and also I like that he kind of discusses so pulling from memory. So he starts to equate, you know, the memory of the embryo and the memory of the brain of the adult organism, which is really interesting. And I'm sure we'll go into that more. And also that when the brain does pull from a memory, it just for an instant becomes closed off to all other equipotentiality to attend to this, and then opens back up. That's interesting. I mean, then just also this last line here, I don't have a lot to say about it, but again, I kind of mentioned this before the call, but he says, a senseful theme, which the observable structure expresses but does not exhaust, can only have a subjective existence, which I find kind of fascinating. I think part of that is because I'm in the Klosowski reading as well, and this idea of subjectivity is interesting. So, you know, I mean, I guess in the embryo, it has a subjective existence. It most likely is not objectifying its subjective existence, whereas the brain does. I think that's a whole nother conversation, but I don't know. I just the possibility for exploration of that line is pretty fascinating. So, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. So here he's picking up again on this sort of analogy of technical creation, so an invention, and the sort of psychological equivalent. And so there, a previous chapter, we saw that he's sort of basically he's making an argument by analogy, essentially that if something in the case of these external technical objects would be treated as an invention, then we should treat the equivalent entity within a biological organism as an invention as well. So he talks about how, like, cooking, for example, you take a pot and fill it with water and throw some vegetables in it and put it on the fire. This is essentially just externalizing the digestion process that you would do in your stomach. And of course, I mean, a cooking pot doesn't seem like a super, like, you know, sophisticated invention from our perspective, but it still is an invention. Someone had to, you know, figure out that this was something that was possible and worth doing. And then, so if this sort of external digestion system is something invented, then we should also see our own internal digestive system as an invention. Although, of course, it's not an invention in the sense of, like, there was no sort of person, even a gaseous vertebrate, who was, you know, drawing up a blueprint of a human body and said, you know, we should put a digestive organ here. But it's this, you know, invention that happened over the course of evolution in different biological organisms' sort of capacity to extract nutrients from food. And so what it means to describe both of these as an invention, both the external technical invention and the internal, I guess, biological invention, is that in each case there's a sort of theme that is being introduced into the spatiotemporal world. So it's not in the case of the biological invention, there's no sort of like grasp of the theme at the outset, in the sense that there's no person that is sort of drawing up a blueprint and then building the stomach on the model of this blueprint. But it's still the case that there is this sort of theme of, you know, capacity to digest food or you know, in some abstract sense. And then that theme comes to be realized in you know, the spatiotemporal world, either in a biological organ or in this, you know, technical apparatus that is the cooking pot. I like this line, relative to the embryo that he was. It is kind of weird to think about, you know, of course, each of us was an embryo at one point. It's kind of a strange thought, I guess. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit. I can read this part. There is no reason to imagine that this primary consciousness or subjectivity of the quote-unquote determined young embryo is vague, confused, or psychoid rather than psychic, a la Hartman, Becher, Bleuler, or Psycho-Lamarckians. The precise or vague character of a consciousness can only be inferred from the structure of the systems or behaviors it establishes. Embryonic systems and behaviors are miracles of subtlety and precision. No doubt the theme, quote-unquote, foot, or the theme, quote-unquote, lung, or quote-unquote, kidney, is abstract at the outset, as we have stressed, but an abstract idea is not a vague idea. P. Weiss called his theory the muscle name theory, probably in jest, and thought he was offering a pure metaphor, but he touched on the crux of the matter. The metaphor only bears on the word name. Obviously, the embryonic muscle does not know its quote-unquote name as extensor or flexor, but it certainly knows its own nature. It knows its own sense, if not its signification. The embryo's primary consciousness is no more vague than the consciousness of the adult. It has another direction. It, quote-unquote, concerns itself uniquely with the organs it is constructing. A worker absorbed in his labor forgets the rest of the world. This certainly makes the external world vague for him, but not the object on which he labors. Quite the contrary. As the organic labor is pursued, primary consciousness, at first equipotential, seems to lose itself in the more or less automatic structures it establishes. The worker seems to disappear in the work. The distribution of equipotentiality, which allows the division of organic labor, is no doubt accompanied by a distribution of primary consciousness, since a graft transplanted after determination develops, quote-unquote, mindlessly, according to its origin and not according to its new place. But even if this distribution has to correspond to a dissipation of primary consciousness, it cannot be understood as a passage to the vague state. In a sense, the quote-unquote I of adult consciousness is a specimen of this quote-unquote distributed primary consciousness, because it is not tied to the entire organism but to the nervous system, and not particularly to the cortex as an organ of behavior. And particularly to the cortex as an organ of behavior. Quote-unquote I consciousness is not quote-unquote vague relative to its own tasks. It is, quote, in the dark, unquote, relative to organs other than the brain and relative to the brain itself, as irrigated breathing organ or as seed of various chemical phenomena. But nothing allows us to suppose that primary consciousness distributed to other organs is more confused relative to these organs than the, quote-unquote, I consciousness relative to sensations and behavior. For these primary consciousnesses, for example, for the mnemic rhythms of autonomous cardiac centers, it is our, quote-unquote, I consciousness that would appear as confused and, quote, psychoid rather than psychic, unquote. I'm not sure what that is a reference to. There's a footnote, you know, stating the reference here. Our, quote-unquote, I ideas are very vague relative to the operation of our organism. Let us be fair, then, and not expect too much of the ideas of our primary organic consciousness vis-a-vis external behavior, which is the affair of the, quote-unquote, I. The discovery of blood circulation was a feat on Harvey's part. The admiration for Harvey gives the measure of what the admiration for the, quote-unquote, I consciousness in general must be. If our heart and arteries had the time to judge our brain, they would not have a very high opinion of its capacity. It has taken so many centuries to become aware of what happens a few decimeters from it and even within it. I like that last bit is pretty funny. So here we have this distinction between primary and secondary consciousness. We were talking about this a little bit before we started recording. So this primary consciousness is what he's describing as this sort of inner experience of the living being or of any true form. It has this sort of inner aspect, and so in this case, so this applies, you know, to the embryo itself as it's developing, of course, also to subatomic particles. We haven't seen much about that in this book, but he does, you know, consider them to be true forms as well. So this last passage, he's sort of arguing against one way that of sort of maybe taming this idea would be to say that, like, okay, maybe there is something like an inner experience in the embryo as it's differentiating, but it must be a sort of vague and obscure analog to consciousness. It can't be sort of as clear and differentiated as our consciousness, you know, while we're, you know, writing an essay or whatever. Ruyer essentially argues that there's no reason to suppose that that's the case, that it can't be actually as clear as our own, you know, awareness of what we're doing. He thinks that this assumption of the sort of obscurity or vagueness probably arises as a result of our own sort of only vague conception or vague grasp of many of the phenomena going on in our own bodies that, of course, you know, if you so, for example, you can often recognize if your heartbeat is, you know, unusually fast or something like that, or if you, you know, have a sort of irregular heartbeat or something. If there's something unusual going on with the way your heart is beating, you might notice that. But in your sort of normal everyday life, you don't notice your heart beating at all. Although, of course, it is beating the whole time. Otherwise, you would be dead. So this like heartbeat is sort of underlying our awareness all the time. And you can sort of focus on it if you, you know, for whatever reason, decide to pay attention to it. But it's sort of only vaguely there, or it has a sort of obscurity that sort of covers it most of the time when we aren't, you know, directly focusing on it, or when our attention is not drawn to it by something unusual. And then, you know, other elements are even more obscure. You know, there's like effects of different, you know, hormones in your body that can change your mood, for example. But of course, you don't have sort of an awareness, oh, my levels of X hormone are low or high or whatever. You just, you know, have a sort of general sense of being happy or angry or whatever. And so we have this sort of very obscure grasp of many of the things that are going on in our body. And then temptation here is to assume that, you know, to the extent that there is something like an experience going on in my heart, it must be similarly obscure as my own sort of general awareness of my heart when I'm not specifically focusing on it. And so Rie said there's no good reason really to assume that that's the case. And, you know, in particular, when we think about like how, you know, in differentiation of the embryo, for example, there's so many complicated processes that have to happen in this like coordinated fashion, that, you know, these differentiations of cells have to happen before, you know, these cells move from point A to point B and so on. All this has to be sort of coordinated in this intricate way. It seems strange to describe that as like a sort of vague or obscure sort of grasp of the embryo of itself. So it seems like there's a lot of awareness going on within us that we as psychological subjects are not aware of.
Yeah, this section, and maybe especially that quote about if the heart could judge the brain, it wouldn't have a very high opinion of it. I think somewhere Nietzsche suggests that the, you know, the nervous system is kind of a latecomer to the evolutionary scene, or like relatively late development in the history of the body. I don't know how historically accurate that is. I mean, obviously nervous systems had to evolve, but also that it often misinterprets the body. And there's, yeah, kind of an interesting convergence with Rouillet on this, the idea that the organs have their own kind of experience that's precise in itself that might not always be very well understood by secondary consciousness.
Yeah, it's definitely true that nervous systems are relatively late, in sort of the evolutionary history of living beings, they appear relatively late. And of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, all these other organisms that existed, you know, without nervous systems didn't have this sort of inner side to them. There's been, I've talked about this in a few other sessions, but there's been, yeah, in the last, you know, 20 or so years, I guess, much more, I think, awareness of living beings of various kinds, and many of which don't have nervous systems, doing things that we would consider, you know, psychological or cognitive tasks, you know, if they were performed by animals that have a nervous system. And so there's been, I think, a lot more willingness to just say something like, yeah, these bacteria really are, you know, performing a cognitive task, and not just sort of doing something like a cognitive task. And of course, the sort of, and I think Rui has made this argument earlier in this book, or maybe in the cybernetics book, but if you sort of suppose that you need a nervous system to be able to, you know, perform these kind of cognitive tasks, then you are sort of leaving mysterious what exactly is going on within an individual neuron. Like, of course, the neuron itself doesn't have a nervous system, within it that is performing its operations. And so, yeah, whatever the neuron is doing is not sort of governed by a micro nervous system. And then, so if that neuron is itself capable of doing this, operation without needing sort of to be governed by a nervous system, then it seems that we don't actually need that nervous system, to explain what, a slime mold is doing, for example, that, they're capable of doing all kinds of interesting things without having a nervous system. And so the nervous system, of course, one of the main functions of a nervous system is to accelerate the transmission of signals from one portion of a body to another. Many organisms that don't have a nervous system rely on chemical communication. So that one region will sort of disseminate a chemical that passes to other regions. But this is a relatively slow process. It might take, several minutes for whatever chemical is being sort of circulated to get from, point A to point B in the organism. Whereas, of course, in our nervous system, you can get a signal from the brain to the foot within, a few milliseconds, right? So, so just creating the capacity to regulate behavior is one important function. Larger scale coordination of behavior. So something like a walking behavior, for example, you have to ensure that legs on both sides of the body are synchronized in the right way. Having these two sides of the body that might be widely separated from each other link up in the right way and move in such a way that the organism as a whole maintains balance and moves forward. Requires a connection that is hard to institute by a kind of diffusion of a chemical or something along those lines. So there's different, capacities that a nervous system gives an organism that are presumably how, the reason why they evolved anyway, but it doesn't mean that this is sort of like an essential component of, an organism having that inner experience. It's something that, changes what kinds of inner experience and what kinds of behavior that organism is going to have, but it doesn't sort of endow that organism with inner experience for the first time.
Yeah, I like here as he starts to set up, I hesitate to say layers, but I'm going to say these layers of consciousness, the primary consciousness, the I consciousness, and where we would kind of give primacy to the I consciousness, and say, okay, you're reading this, you could say, okay, well, there's a primary consciousness, but it's just this vague, nebulous term that he's giving to this, but he's starting to lay it out here that, no, this is not a vague or primitive form of consciousness, and the I consciousness has come along and outdone it or something. I can't help but think about just the implications here with with the Klosowski reading or even like Zen Buddhism or something where you do have where the I consciousness is kind of this late arriver and is the illusory consciousness of the objectified subject. I don't think that's exactly what Ruyer is saying here. It's going to be interesting as we continue to go to see how these different philosophies and these different concepts overlap and how they differ.
Yeah, I don't think he would say, there's definitely connections to be made there, but I don't think he would say that the secondary consciousness is illusory. It's just that it's not sort of, its function is not to sort of copy the primary consciousness. That would not really be that useful. It's just to have like a second copy that you could look at or something. Of course, the secondary consciousness, so our sort of like psychological subjectivity, is mostly directed outwards at the objects in the world that we're dealing with. We have some awareness of our own body, but mostly only insofar as we need that awareness to be able to manage our sort of behavior in the world in a sort of adequate way. So like if you feel a sense of pain in one of your limbs, that's a sign that you shouldn't use that limb to manipulate the world or something like that. But you know, you're sort of like the sort of intrinsic experience of each of your muscle cells is not really relevant to your capacity to use the muscles to move your limb to manipulate objects. Our secondary consciousness, subjectivity is generally directed to, you know, navigating and manipulating the world. It only sort of gives us access to what's happening in the rest of our body insofar as that is relevant to, you know, the sort of primary task of navigating the world. If we try to sort of use that awareness of our bodies that we get through that secondary consciousness, if we try to sort of use that as like an accurate depiction of what's going on in our body, then of course we will be led astray, but that's not really what it's for.
Yeah. And the section here where he talks about the worker losing themselves in the work, this where primary consciousness as an equipotential consciousness, as it becomes more focused, it becomes a little less equipotential, as it's lost in this specific task. Pulsing in and out of equipotentiality, I guess.
Yeah, to give a strange analogy, but there's a Sherlock Holmes story, I can't remember which one, but Sherlock Holmes somehow, I can't remember what the chain of events is, but anyway, he gets like a writing sample from the person that he's trying to track down, and he's able to determine based on variations in the writing, what train the person was on when they were writing it. You know, there's like a jostling of the train at a certain point, and that makes the writing, you know, blurrier at this point or whatever. And so the person who was writing this text presumably was not sort of like writing in order to leave a mark of what train they were on. They were, you know, writing in order to express certain ideas or to put certain, to take themes out of this, you know, non-spatial temporal realm and incarnate them on paper. The jostling of the train was just a sort of incidental, side effect that maybe made it easier or harder to do that theme incarnation task. And so likewise, in the case of, you know, our awareness, so the sort of analogy I'm getting in here is that like we, as we go about, you know, navigating the world and manipulating objects, are not sort of directing ourselves towards what our body is doing during that time. But of course, the, you know, all the different things that are going on, all the different processes going on in our body affect, you know, how we go about navigating the world. And so, like, you can sort of read off from the behavior of your body something about, you know, the state of your body and what's going on in your body. If you're an athlete and you your performance on one occasion is much worse than usual, you could probably deduce that there's something going on, that, you know, maybe you're starting to get sick or whatever. You're sort of like observing your performance from outside and then deducing, you know, what might be causing your performance to be, you know, not what it normally is. And so this is sort of like analogous to the way that you would, the way that Sherlock Holmes is, deducing what train the person was on, based on the sort of variations in the writing, on the paper. So again, it's like the purpose of writing is not to, you know, leave a mark on the paper of what train you're on. And just as the purpose of, you know, playing basketball is not to like give evidence of whether or not you're sick. But you can use your performance in the basketball game as like a sign that you are sick or something like that.
Yeah, I like that. So like, I mean, I guess one of the things he's kind of doing subtly here is disabusing that infinite regress of consciousness that we might attribute to the I consciousness, that I am the one responsible for this I consciousness, and that it's really just functioning just like the primary consciousness, as an equipotential response to what is given to it. I don't know if that makes sense how I'm saying that. It makes sense in my head.
Yeah, so we're going to get into the more about this differentiation between the primary and secondary consciousness in a later chapter. But yeah, so he points out here in this text, or in the bit we just read, that of course our sort of psychological subjectivity, you know, insofar as it has to do with our nervous system, is itself something that that is part of the living organism. That, you know, the nervous system is not some second thing outside of our body. It's you know, part of the living being, and so it has its own, you know, primary consciousness, and the sort of secondary consciousness, this, you know, I consciousness, is sort of like a subset of the consciousness of all the different sort of primary consciousnesses that make up my body. Yeah, so it's like there's a very thin sort of I don't know, filtration, I guess, of like what is you know, what, which parts of that primary consciousness of everything that makes up my body, which sort of aspects of that get sort of brought together to form something like an I consciousness. It's just sort of like a one sort of selection out of that whole giant mass of all these other elements that don't actually make it in. And actually, just comes to mind here. So he gives that sort of like joking sort of a depiction of the heart, you know, not being particularly impressed by the brain discovering the circulation of blood. But even sort of further than that, you can point to like how, you know, Aristotle thought that the brain's primary function was for cooling the blood, and that, you know, the sort of seat of sensibility and reasoning and so on was the heart. And this is like, you know, a common sort of depiction in many cultures around the world, that like, you know, the heart is where, or sort of somewhere in the sort of center of your thorax slash abdomen is sort of like the where you are, your sort of subjectivity is located. So even just like the general region of the body that is sort of most connected to subjectivity is not something that we can just sort of like intuit, that we just have a sort of internal awareness of. Yeah, even like, yeah, what part of the body is sort of most directly involved is something that we only learn, you know, through a sort of external observation and experiments and so on.
I can read the next section. Did we leave off at what may mislead us?
Yeah, I think that's right.
What may mislead us in this question is that the quote-unquote I consciousness tied to the brain only receives the communications of organic consciousness in the form of instinctive drives, often peremptory, but always imprecise and quote-unquote protopathic. The quote-unquote I consciousness is thus inclined to attribute to total organic consciousness, when it believes in it, the same traits it attributes to its communications. A sexual drive, for example, is no doubt vague for the quote-unquote I consciousness that is not aware of its nature. Quote, I don't know what's happening to me, unquote, exclaims Cherubino, who, per the footnote, is a character in the Magic Flute. Yet it is quite natural for the communication between distributed consciousness to have, for the communication between distributed consciousnesses to have a confused character, which none of the distributed consciousnesses shares. The sexual drive in the quote-unquote I consciousness is confused, but the formative instincts to speak like von Monokov and Morgue, pronounce that had to make the male or female gametes according to a rigorous quote-unquote machining, that had to construct not only the sexual organs, but also the very complicated physiological cycles that allow hormonal and neural sensitization, are necessarily quite precise. It is simply absurd to believe, a la Schopenhauer and von Hartmann, followed by contemporary psycho-Lamarckians, that these formative instincts are a sort of degraded consciousness or an unconscious will. In all likelihood, the sexual sensitization of the nervous system and of the quote-unquote I consciousness results from procedures like the one through which, during embryonic development, an already determined area induces in its turn the determination of a neighboring area by means of a chemical. It is the endocrine condition of the blood, rather than the neural incitations coming from the organs, that determines the eroticization of the nervous system. Each area is equipotential in itself, and to this equipotentiality corresponds a precise consciousness. but the influential passages from one area to neighboring areas are translated by a confused impression in the influenced area until the invoked mnemic themes differentiate consciousnesses at the same time as the organs or behaviors at issue. Cherubino quickly becomes wiser. From the vague and atmospheric impressions induced by the Madeleine, Proust reconstructs the immense edifice of his recollections. Touched by the optical vesicle, the ectodermic tissue rapidly constructs a lens and a cornea from a simple thickening of the cephalic epiblast. These three facts are perfectly equivalent. In each case, it is a matter of the passage from one domain of equipotential survey to another. One, in the evolution of species, the nervous system is at the primitive stage, very rudimentary. Oh, whoops, I skipped over the items. Okay, so these are the three passage items. One, either from one embryonic area to another. Two, or from the organic domain to the psychological domain, instinct. Three, or from a mnemic sphere closed onto itself to the quote-unquote eye consciousness. Okay, I'll stop there. Yeah, so this develops the point that he made in the last section, that the primary consciousness of a given organ is clear sort of for itself, but obscure for neighboring, the consciousness of neighboring organs. And so even though, you know, the hormonal system only appears for the eye consciousness as a kind of obscure, if peremptory, unthematized command, that doesn't mean that it's obscure in itself, as if, you know, that system didn't know what it was doing, or in general, as if the kind of transmitting organ was as obscure in itself as it appears to the organ to which it transmits something. Yeah, a couple of questions that crop up for me in this section is, and this is related to a point Organelles made in the chat. I know that he argues that the brain is sort of specially equipotential. It is more equipotential than other organs, and it retains that equipotentiality, whereas, for instance, the embryo exhausts its equipotentiality in the process of development. But he also says that he says here, each area is equipotential in itself. So it seems that each organ retains some equipotentiality, which may be the same thing as primary consciousness. It just doesn't have, as the other organs don't have as much equipotentiality as the brain has. I think that's what he's saying, but I'm not entirely sure. And then the other thing that this section made me think of is, you know, if this kind of obscure to clear movement characterizes communication between organs and the body, or, you know, developing zones in the embryo, whether that is the case for human communication as well. You know, whether there is, even if it's kind of less confused impression, if there's something kind of analogous to this, you know, a relatively obscure signaling from one secondary consciousness to another by means of speech or signs.
Yeah, picking up on that last point, like in Proust, there's all these like passages where it's like one, they're like, you know, at some sort of salon or whatever, and one person, you know, says something and they sort of use a phrase that they don't really understand, but they picked up from someone else. And then the other person, you know, that sort of like triggers this whole, you know, elaborate digression that lasts like 50 pages in the second person, you know, the sort of like, you know, what they connect with that phrase and where they've heard it before and sort of like the whole history of their relationship to that phrase and so on. So maybe we can think of that as like analogous to the way that, you know, one organ in the human body communicates with another in this, there's a sort of like triggering of something that happens, like one sort of organ will send a signal to the other, and then the second organ undergoes some sort of process as a result of this signal. But it's not the case that, but yeah, so like receiving that signal might be sort of an obscure, something obscure or vague or whatever, but the differentiation, the development or the process that the the second organ undergoes after receiving that signal is not itself sort of vague or obscure. And so, yeah, likewise, in the case of the two people in the salon in Proust, they're like the second person who receives the signal might, you know, undergo this elaborate process of, you know, this chain of associations or whatever upon hearing the phrase that the first person uses. And that sort of psychological process going on in the second person is not vague or obscure, even if it has relatively little to do with, you know, the meaning of the phrase that the first person said in sort of a standard sense. And going back to the first point, I think maybe the sort of heart of the ambiguity here is about like the scale that he's the sort of ambiguity of scale, because it's clear that individual cells are true forms for him, and so they have this primary consciousness or equipotentiality. It's not 100% clear, you know, whether we should be attributing this kind of primary consciousness to organs. Like, does the kidney have, you know, the kidney as a whole organ have primary consciousness, or is it just a sort of assemblage of cells that each have their own primary consciousness? It's not clear, and I think this is something we talked about in the conclusion of the cybernetics book when he went through some of these same ideas. This is sort of like a general objection or problem that's been raised for panpsychist or related types of theories, is that like, how do you, what does it mean exactly to sort of combine experiences of, say, like individual cells into the experience of the whole body, or, you know, in this case, like each of the kidney cells has its own experience or its own primary consciousness, but do those primary consciousnesses add up to a primary consciousness of the kidney as a whole? It's not 100% clear what Ruyer's answer to that question would be. It does certainly seem to be the case that the kidney, the sort of structure of the kidney is more fixed than the structure of the brain, in the sense that it has less of this capacity to undergo, you know, transformations and to change itself in these ways. Whether that should be understood as a kind of primary consciousness of the kidney that is just sort of limited in terms of what it can do, or, you know, just a sort of assemblage of primary consciousnesses that are not itself, that don't themselves sort of add up to a primary consciousness of the kidney.
Yeah, I went back a little bit to on page 69, where he's talking about the brain as an area that remains embryonic. He says that the rest of the organism, having finished its growth, retains some contact with this domain, so the transtemporal mnemic domain, only to the extent that it cannot be reduced to pure substituted mechanisms, to the extent that mnemic themes and rhythms carried over from the embryonic state continue to inspect, in quotes, these innumerable machines. So maybe he sees it as a reduced equipotentiality that kind of, somehow maintains and keeps an order, or just, you know, is the action of maintaining and keeping order of itself by these organs.
Yeah, it's certainly not an all or nothing. It's not that, you know, either there is sort of a consciousness of the kidney or there isn't. It has to do with the sort of organization of the kidney. Certain organs, there are certain parts of the human body that are parts only for an external observer, that, like, you know, as someone doing an anatomical dissection, you might sort of group these pieces of the body together into one entity. And then, of course, there are also, you know, parts of the human body that have a certain unity or self-containedness, to a relative extent, for the body as a living organism. The heart, for example, is sort of like a unit in a sense. It's not, that's obviously not going to be a yes or no question, because of course there's different degrees of unification, I guess. And then, so you could ask, like, you know, is the, you know, if maybe the kidney is a unit, you know, are the pair is like the pair of kidneys, the sort of renal system as a whole, is that also a unit? Yeah, so I think in a lot of cases, it's going to be difficult to, you know, decide on like what scales we want to sort of use for our analysis. You might be able to, it might change depending on what sort of the specific question you're working on is. But yeah, it's a little bit, he doesn't give us a very straightforward way of deciding, you know, when we want to, or when it makes sense to attribute something like primary consciousness to some entity within a living organism.
Yeah, I don't have the answer for this, but I feel like maybe it's relevant when going back to the section where Royer makes this statement relative to the embryo that they were, the adult realizes, in a sense, the ancient myth of the divinity that is transformed into a laurel tree. I only have a vague understanding what he means there, but does anyone know exactly what that myth is? I just did a quick look, and it's when the nymph Daphne transformed into a laurel tree to escape the unwanted pursuit of Apollo. So, I mean, that's interesting. So if the transformation to a laurel tree is to escape something, to escape an unwanted pursuit of something, I'm sure there's so much more context to this. And the adult is sort of mirroring that transformation relative to the embryo. I don't know. I'm going to have to look into that after this reading or after this one today.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember what exactly goes on in that story, but is that one where she sort of gets stuck as the laurel tree and can't like sort of turn back into her, I don't know, original form, whatever exactly it was? Yeah, I can't remember. I think that might be the case, but I'm not sure exactly. Anyway, I think that's what is sort of going on, what this sort of reference to this story is. It's that so this nymph presumably has the capacity to, you know, Daphne presumably has the capacity to transform herself into many different things. So she has this equipotentiality. But then once she has transformed herself into the laurel tree, then she's kind of like, you know, fixed herself into a certain form. And so I don't know for sure whether she actually sort of gets stuck in that form, but she at least would have to sort of transform back into her original form, into this sort of equipotential state before she could undergo that new differentiation into a new form.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, going back to that and what Angus was saying, I mean, right before that, Royer makes the statement that the primitive embryonic equipotentiality thus disappears progressively. It is distributed in more and more limited areas. The theme of the organs, so these areas retain that theme, that sense, but the finalist sense is incarnated or fossilized, so that it's kind of within that domain, versus remaining open, such as the early embryo or the brain that has the potential to continue to expand that equipotentiality to, you know, to kind of expand and then close in to one domain and then expand back out, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Okay, so I think we can maybe stop here for today. Getting PDF up again. Yeah, okay, yeah, we can stop here. And then, yeah, pick up, I think next week should be good. Thanks, everyone.